at the moon. Don't know or what I am. In your arms a while, face a baby for knows to smile. But there's no trace. Everywhere I turn, you kiss my face.
Namaste and blessings. This Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Welcome to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. Today we will continue our exploration of the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California, who in 2007 became the very first white-skinned, American-born human being to be brought into the rank of the A.D. Mahamandaleshwars, whose dharma it is to disseminate and defend Sanatana Dharma. Now, you might not be familiar with the term Sanatana Dharma, but that is what is commonly referred to as Hinduism. Hinduism is not what it's been called for thousands and thousands of years. It is Sanatana Dharma or Sanatana Dharma. What that means is the eternal natural way. The way by which any human can turn their attention and their focus inwards, upwards, and outwards. And very much like a salmon swimming upstream, get back to where they came from, thereby achieving stable enlightenment and eventual liberation from the wheel of birth and death. So, thanking Sonic over there in Brighton, England, for pushing the buttons and making this thing sound good. Today, we will begin our exploration. This is episode number 14. And today we will begin with verse number 135. Now, these verses came originally from Sanskrit and were translated to English by Acharya Padma Najendra. So it is her work that we are reading when it comes to the translation of these verses from the Sanskrit. Then there will be commentary that is written into the text from Swami Anantanandagiri. And then following that, this Swami will add, if there's anything this Swami feels needs to be added or explained. So let's begin with verse 135. Shiva says to, forgot to tell you that part. This whole Guru Gita, this ancient text, is a conversation between Shiva, the Mahadeva, the god of the gods, to his wife, Parvati, and explaining how the Guru works, what is important, what things to focus on, and such. So, verse 135, Shiva said to Parvati, one should worship the Guru until they see no difference between the seer and the seen. Only one such as this attains liberation. One who thinks otherwise does not. Again, that verse. This is extremely important. One should worship the Guru until they see no difference between the seer and the seen. Only one such as this attains liberation. One who thinks otherwise does not. The commentary. Regardless of how enlightened one may fancy themselves, they are neither enlightened nor liberated who do not perceive the complete and utter unity underlying everything at all times. While the appearance of individuality may still be perceived, it is but a shadow superimposed on the light of consciousness. The apparently separate universe of diverse phenomena is dense with consciousness, which is all-pervading and, truly speaking, utterly devoid of interstices. The seer, the seen, and the act of seeing are all expressions of the infinite self. One who is fully enlightened and liberated couldn't avoid seeing this everywhere, even if they tried. At this point in human evolution, the perception of non-duality is natural and effortless in all circumstances. The Sanskrit term for this is Sahaja Samadhi. such a one who experiences this without a moment of hesitation or doubt is known as a Jivan Mukti, one who is liberated while yet embodied. Until this is the case, one must take advantage of what the guru has to offer. Now, allow this Swami to speak briefly on the two different types of mukti, or freedom. Really, it's not, okay, not that the states themselves are different, but the point at which they occur is different. The Jivan Mukti is one who becomes free while embodied. That means while the body is still functional. Then there is, which is a relatively rare situation. The far more common situation is called Videha Mukti, and that is when you cross the finish line, when the body ceases function. You then cross the finish line, and then there is no further need for incarnation at any level, for any reason at all. Moving on, verse 136. Shiva says to Parvati, even one who has tasted knowledge, capital K, knowledge, will be faced with terrible distraction and restlessness if they abandon the guru at the time of death. The commentary. It is common to experience the infinite self. It is so common, in fact, that people often catch a glimpse here and there without ever giving these experiences a second thought. Generally speaking, whether or not one recognizes and appreciates such an experience for what it is, it comes as a flash of insight that is quickly occulted once again by the clouds of mental conditioning. It is by mental conditioning that the human being is bound to the cycle of transmigration, referred to as samsara, the wheel of birth and death. As long as this conditioning of the mind remains, the individual remains identified with, and therefore confined to, the body-mind complex. In this limited condition, the individual remains bound to the universe of diverse appearances and is subject to the laws that govern it. This mental conditioning must be eradicated. The guru is the means by which this occurs. The state of the one in which this is the case is that described in the above verse and the corresponding commentary. One will have many, many lofty experiences on the way to Sahaja Samadhi, but should never become conceited over these and think it appropriate to abandon the guru. Even having seen and become the infinite, eternal source of all, or God. One's work is not finished if the perspective cannot be maintained. Without the guru, even at this stage, one must necessarily fall victim to confusion and restlessness, thus remaining deprived of final liberation. Now, lots and lots of area there for people to pick over and fuss about. No, this is just straight up how it is. The guru is the means by which this occurs. It doesn't happen except in some very, very rare instances. Does something this high, this expanded, occur without the direct assistance of someone who is already in this position? It is possible, but not likely. One of the, well, let's just go no further. If you're listening to this, you ain't there yet anyway. So, let's move forward. We're going to do in one go here, verses 137 to 141, because this is an important section. So we'll just do them all in a row here. Shiva says to Parvati, "The disciple should not ignore his duty to the guru. He should not take action without first consulting the guru. He should salute the guru before he rises in the morning. These are the proper attitudes to have toward the guru. While in the presence of the guru, one should never give orders or advice to others. One who does this will become a demon. The disciple should not indulge in prohibited acts like drinking alcohol and the like in the guru's ashram. He should not give talks, should not behave as if he were Lord or initiate anyone else while in the guru's ashram. In the guru's ashram, one should abstain from laziness and from frivolities such as luxurious bedding and cushions. One should not stretch their legs in front of the guru, nor should one offer gratification to the body, nor engage in other manners of playful indulgence. One should not ignore the commands of the guru, whether they seem just or unjust. Like a servant, one should carry out the guru's command day and night." The commentary. "One does not go to the dwelling of the guru, known as an ashram, to experience sensual gratification or to lead a luxurious life. The seeker's place is not to put him or herself up on a pedestal. The seeker is there to do work inwardly and outwardly, to serve the guru and to allow the guru to extinguish the error of ego identification. The guru's dwelling is a place for discipline, respect, and humility. If you want creature comforts, go get yourself a room at the Marriott. If you want vice, go spend your money in Las Vegas. If you want to feel important, take acting classes and get an agent. Or maybe become a politician. Don't bring those sorts of expectations to the guru's presence unless you want them knocked out of you. Allow this, Swami, to go on a bit here. When we say knocked out of you, this doesn't mean physically. Okay? You must understand that the entire task of the guru is to assist you to become free of that which keeps you bound to birth and death. And seeking, desiring pleasure over discomfort, over humility, is the very thing that is keeping you from accomplishing this task. And it has for many, 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 many lifetimes. But that's okay. This is how it works. But when you are in the ashram, when you are in the home of the guru or guru's representative, because there are gurus who will ordain and empower swamis under their direction to do certain things, as this swami has been ordained and empowered to do. So regardless whether you're with the guru or the guru's representative, the respect level remains the same. Because without the guru's empowerment and authorization to do the things that this swami seems to do, it wouldn't happen at all. I can guarantee you that. Verse 142, Shiva said to Parvati, the disciple should accept only what is given by Guru and should spend that wealth only with the utmost reservation. By living in this manner, one will obtain merit and longevity. Now, when it comes to equanimity, our commentary is, what has been given by the guru is whatever comes one's way unsolicited, without striving for anything that is deemed desirable, or shrinking away from anything that is deemed undesirable. The disciple should strive to accept their lot gracefully. By cultivating equanimity in this way, the unnecessary mental activity associated with attachment and aversion becomes less habitual. Less wrapped up in mental processes, one is more prone at any given moment to rest content at a deeper, simpler, less dualistic level of awareness. Now, in that verse, longevity was spoken of, and related to frugality. Kindly allow this, Swami, to remind you of the quote. By living in this manner, one will obtain merit and longevity, end quote. The above-named merit yields numerous fruits. We could think of the variety of reward described briefly under the section titled Equanimity, which we just covered, as liberating karma, or something along those lines. In the section that followed, having an intelligent, conscious, and responsible relationship with precipitation, as an example of spending the wealth given by the guru only with ultimate reservation. It is true that the Puranas, which is a group of ancient texts, have enumerated an impressive list of heavenly rewards that result from planting trees. It doesn't take much imagination to see how this sort of a relationship with one's environment has the potential to result in wealth and abundance as well. Stepping away from the text for a moment, please keep in mind, wealth does not mean money in all cases. Okay? So if you're thinking in that way, drop it. That's not what we're talking about. Your bank account has nothing to do with this. Thus, we have an example of another sort of fruit that can be had by adhering to the ethics advocated in this verse. Rumi echoed this theme, at least in part, when he said, quote, "In the hands of the wise, earth turns to gold," end quote. Without delving into the subject of permaculture deeply, I would like to point out that certain other design strategies carry benefits worth mentioning here as well. For example, the growing of biodiverse or ecosystemic crops has been shown to yield more nutrient-dense foods than even food carrying the highly touted organic label. Also, promoted by permaculture is the cultivation of one's own food crops, locally sourcing whatever food isn't grown oneself, and eating only foods when they are in season. These are all factors that studies have linked to triple-digit lifespans. And they are also intimately linked to the ethics enumerated herein. It is my hope that in touching upon these topics, I have managed to take the somewhat abstract assertion that spending the wealth given by the guru only with the utmost reservation can, in fact, bring merit and longevity, and have demonstrated it in a really concrete way. I would also like to add, adherence to these ethics is beneficial at any order of magnitude. Stepping away from the text, Swami Anantananda is a certified permaculture person. This Swami edited out a whole lot of the permaculture content because it's not relevant to this Swami's presentation. Okay? So there will be occasional references to that which was edited out because this is not a show about permaculture. There's all sorts of ways to find that kind of information. If that's what you're looking for, you don't need this Swami to give it to you. Back to the text. I simply dove into the subject of permaculture in this instance because it illustrates certain aspects of the cause and effect relationship asserted here by the Guru Gita in a dramatic way. The directive to utilize the resources at one's disposal and thus reap the corresponding rewards applies across the board. It applies equally to the individual who is responsible for handling a paycheck and to a king who is responsible for governing an empire. Kindly allow this Swami to elaborate just a bit. The bottom line here is learning and adapting your mind to accepting what comes, being comfortable with what you have, rather than developing desire for gain of material objects and status that are not really even necessary. This is part of the simplifying of one's life. And as you pay attention and begin dropping these attachments and desires for things that really aren't even necessary, this is how, by strengthening the attitude that I have what I need and what I don't have or need is coming. When you get too twisted up about how it comes, that's where the problems come in. Now, back to the text. Verse 143. Shiva said to Parvati, articles that have been used by the guru, such as footwear, seats, and bedding should not be touched by the feet of the disciple. They should be saluted and always treated with utmost respect. The commentary. In Eastern culture, to touch something with one's feet is considered disrespectful. If this happens by accident, one can request pardon by first touching their fingers to their eyes and then touching the same fingers to the object that was unintentionally disrespected. We'll go ahead and do the bottom of the hour break song and be back with verse 144 here on Meditative Living.
Om Namah Shivaya.
Namaste and blessings. Welcome back to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. This is episode number 14 in the series of the authoritative Guru Gita. If you are just hearing this for the first time, you really ought to go to www.type1radio.com. That's the digit one. And start it from episode one. Otherwise, it's not going to make as much sense. So this is really something you need to pick up from the beginning and follow it through. Now, returning to the text. Verse 144, Shiva said to Parvati, "The disciple should not cross even the shadow of the guru, but should walk behind it. One should not imitate the guru's dress or ornaments." The comment. What can you learn from someone you don't respect? The guru is here to perform a radical transformation of consciousness. The seeker must hold the guru in unequivocally high esteem, lest they run the risk of allowing a skewed perspective to sabotage the guru's efforts. The guru of our guru, Swami Muktananda, often remarked, quote, "I am as you see me," end quote. He related that to people who see him as just an ordinary person, he was a simple and quite unremarkable man. Conversely, the faith of those who saw him as the grace-bestowing power of God allowed them to receive that grace. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Man is made of faith. As his faith is, so he is." stepping away from the text for a moment, Jesus also taught this. His quote, "As a man thinketh, so is he." The guru must be acknowledged as the grace-bestowing power of God in order for the grace to be fully received. If the guru is the grace-bestowing power of God, it behooves the seeker to cultivate and appreciate respect, then go a step further and reinforce the sentiment by demonstrating it. The seeker's place is not to emulate the guru's appearance, mannerisms, or function. The disciple's role is that of a servant. However, as Jesus pointed out, the guru's yoke is easy and his lordship is mild. The guru's feet offer a safe place of refuge in which results come much more easily and quickly. Many a determined but misguided yogi has witnessed unnecessary asceticism and self-denial falling away at the feet of a proper guru. The only catch is that they are not necessarily an ego-friendly place. Allow this Swami to step away from the text for a moment to just verify for you that the guru's purpose is to break the bondage your ego as an individuated body-mind system has upon you. You are more than that. You are utilizing it, most assuredly, but you are far more than that. And that is what you're trying to get to. That is the point of view you wish to live from. That is right understanding. And it takes hard work to get there. And to have any shot, you need some guidance by someone who knows how to get there. This is not book learning stuff. No one ever became enlightened by reading books. Doesn't work that way. This is oral tradition. This is having... There are basically three legs that hold up the stool upon which an enlightened and liberated human sits. One, study and scriptures, which is assisted to the mind. Another, surrender to a qualified master, guru. And three, inner experiences. Those are the three legs that hold one seated and stable. If any of those three are missing, it won't be stable. It cannot be stable. Moving on. Verse 145. Shiva says to Parvati, "In the event that the disciple hears a person speaking ill of the guru and is unable to cut out the tongue of the culprit, he should at least run away and denounce that place." The commentary. I can feel eyebrows going up. All over the place. Yeah, there's a lot in this one for you to get worked up about for a few minutes until you understand. So, let us move along to helping you understand. The first incarnation of Shiva's wife was named Sati. Now, Sati denounced her father upon finding out that he had publicly disrespected Shiva, saying one should cut off, if one can, that vile tongue of unrighteous men who insult the Lord, and then give up one's own life. If one is powerless to do so, one should close one's ears and leave that place. This is proper conduct. She then proceeded to commit ritual suicide in front of everyone present at this event by sitting in meditation and self-immolating by the fire of her yoga. Other stories say she sat in the Havan fire, in the fire the priests had made for the ceremony. Regardless, she was so upset that her father had disrespected her husband, Shiva, that she set herself ablaze. Now, at the heart of this matter is the goddess's assertion that one should adhere to one's own dharma, but should not go out of one's way to decry another's, even if different or apparently contradictory. This assertion is not novel. She is simply reiterating what has been established to be right conduct since ancient times. In the past, legislation was put in place around dharmic injunctions. The purpose of temporal rulers and laws was seen to be the defense and promotion of dharma. While the merit of cutting out tongues as punishment is most certainly debatable, it is irrelevant for our purposes today for a few reasons. Number one, the composition of and execution of such mandates is the responsibility of the Kshatriya class, the rulers and warriors. So even within the caste system of India, if such a thing, barbaric as it sounds, would need to be done, only those in that caste would be the ones to do such a thing. Now, please understand, this is largely metaphoric. Okay? None of us are supposed to cut somebody else's tongue off. That's just a very strong way of putting it. But that is not the literal situation. Number two, the scripture doesn't necessarily mandate that one go around cutting out tongues. It stipulates that if you can't, which we can't, one should simply put the offender in their place verbally and then leave that place. Three, there are no laws on the books in modern times anywhere, of which I am aware, that make provisions for removing someone's tongue. Perhaps stepping away from the text, perhaps in some jihadi place, but we're not there. Incidentally, this is the commentator's Incidentally, I am of the opinion that living somewhere where this is the case is likely a dangerous proposition, as we are in the midst of the Kali Yuga, a dark age, where the general rule of thumb regarding governance is that it is corrupt. In short, the law doesn't back any such mandate, and if it did, it would certainly be abused. Number four, Dharma neither compels nor advises anybody to violate Dharma in order to promote it. While this particular injunction deserves points for dramatic effect, I want to make it known explicitly that we, in the Western Church of Sanatana Dharma, neither demand nor endorse violence for any reason. This includes violence inflicted upon oneself. Let karma sort out the troublemakers, especially in the case that their misdemeanor is not threatening anyone else's life, limb, or property. Violence should only be used in the event it is necessary to defend oneself or another against the immediate threat of bodily injury, and even then, what is done must be done judiciously. Having said that, if one finds themselves in the midst of someone else slandering the guru, this injunction sharply emphasizes one should waste no time in expressing their unwillingness to be party in such an event, before leaving. It is not stated here that one should walk away from that place. We are told they should run. So what is the message? Do not spend any more time in that place than it takes to denounce, to express your displeasure with that individual's words, and then be gone. This is not a time to be timid, to be concerned with being polite or with finishing your business. We're told here in no uncertain terms that one who finds themselves in this situation should make it very clear in a dramatic fashion, if necessary, that they are not okay with what is taking place and that they will have no part in it. Okay? Stepping away from the text. This particular passage, fraught with all kinds of ways to get spun out and wigged out and offended and all of that. Don't let that be the case. Just get the point. If you are the student of a guru, whether just an initiate, or a disciple, or a swami, when someone else within that group who is equal to, above or below you, when you hear them denouncing the guru, it's time to let them know, that's wrong, and I'm not having any part in it. That's the point. Okay? Verse 146. Shiva said to Parvati, one should not disregard the command of the guru. He should neither reject the food left over by the guru nor share it with others. Rather, he should treat it like the food sacrificed to the gods and partake of it himself. The commentary. The remains of the food that is offered to the gods, called prasad, is considered blessed. Sometimes this blessed food is actually supernaturally delicious. This really happens. Since all deities reside within the guru, food that comes into contact with the guru is considered to be prasad in exactly the same way as the food offered to the gods. The Guru Gita recommends that this be taken advantage of and that the individual keep this to themselves rather than to make any kind of a show of it. Now, we'll stop there and we will pick up with verse 147 next week. But back to this prasad thing. Okay. If you do not have the correct understanding, then the ego will get all twisted up about things that are actually quite simple. You are not being asked to be any kind of a hoarder or a thief or depriving anyone. If you are, okay, this is a very specific situation. First of all, you've got to be in the physical presence of the guru who is eating. So, first off, if you're not right there in the room or in the place, then none of this applies to you at all. Okay? If you are, and the guru gives you the food, when he's had or she has had their fill, and they may wish to give it to you as a blessing. This is a relatively important thing. So then you eat it. You don't go and run around making, oh, look, everybody, guru gave it to me. Yeah, no. You just eat it. That's it. Be quiet about it and eat it and take it as a blessing. Okay? Nothing to get all worked up about. It's that simple. And strange at the same time for many of us in Western cultures. A great deal of this stuff is very strange to those of us who grew up in Western cultures. Okay? Keep in mind, this is an ancient text written in the East. And there will be more than one spot where what is talked about just doesn't fit with our Western way of seeing things and doing things. And that's okay too. Okay? Thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be of service. If you would like to contact, do that.